No MPAC in December.
That's great.
Yeah.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Portland City Council Chambers. Today is Thursday, November 18th, 2010. It's 3 p.m., and the City Council will come back from recess. Hi, Carla.
Hello.
Can you please call the roll?
Leonard? Here. Fritz?
Here.
Fish? Saltzman? Adams?
Here. We are going to take testimony on the items number 1512 and 1513. So if you wouldn't mind reading both, that would be great. Mm-hmm.
1512, add new code provisions and amend existing city code provisions to address illegal gun use and violent gang activity in the city. 1513, accept report to ensure effective coordination, oversight, community engagement, and measurable outcomes to prevent and reduce youth and gang violence.
Thank you. Thank you, Carla. Senator Burdick is not in yet, right? Just double check.
We're anticipating her a little bit later.
Okay. Along with Commissioner Judy Shiprack. So when Senator Jenny Burdick and Commissioner Judy Shiprack arrive, if someone would let me know, we'll break with whatever we're doing to provide them the courtesies of the House. We have put together a short PowerPoint intended to walk through the problems that we face as a city when it comes to unsafe firearms use and illegal firearms use. And so we are going to jointly give you that PowerPoint, answer any initial questions from council, take testimony. There will be no votes today. Today is just a reading of all the of the two measures. So would you all like to introduce yourselves for sure. The record?
Sure. I'm Warren Jimenez, Deputy Chief of Staff for the Mayor Sam Adams.
Thank you. I'm Kate Lieber, Public Safety Counsel for Mayor Sam Adams.
Mike Reese, Chief of Police for the Portland Police Bureau.
Great. So let's go to the slideshow.
Great. We good there? So the idea here is to give you a sense of what the issues that we're trying to address and also lay out the policy solutions that are in front of you today around the gun safety initiative. So next slide.
Who's doing the slides? I think you have to do it on the laptop there.
There we go.
There we go.
We're going to start out with what the issue is. So in the state of Oregon, we've seen some pretty drastic statistics. As you can see, there are a couple of key ones there. The homicide rate was the fourth highest ranking cause of death between ages of 15 and 24 in the state of Oregon between 1999 and 2007. We've seen an increase in terms of the gang violence response teams incidents in 2007, approximately a 20% increase over the previous year. We have a slide that reflects the years from 2001 and through to the current year here in just a second. We also know that that although persons of color make up approximately 25% of the city of Portland, really there's a disparagement in terms of being affected by the victims of gun violence more than 50% of the time. And four out of the eight identified hotspots have been areas with increased gun violence for more than two decades. And we've seen that historically to be true across the city. And Lieutenant Dave Hendry, who will be calling up a little bit later, can talk a little bit about the historical areas in the city of Portland. Here's just some statistics. Firearms involved in homicides from 2007 through 2010. You can see that there's been a total of 101. Of those 101, we see 42 of those that are involved with a firearm, which approximately makes up about 42% of those homicides. And here shows the increasing trend in the incidences related to the gang violence response team. You can see from 2001, we had 34 incidences, and you can see the trend increase. 2008 and 2009, we saw 68 in each of those years, and year to date, we've seen 81. And we still have the month of December to get through. So between the discrepancy between the difference between 68 and 81, that's that 20% increase that was referred to in the first slide. This is a table, a couple different tables. What we show here is the first one is the race of persons that are arrested in cases involving aggravated assault or attempted murder with a gun. And you can see we've broken it out by race.
And victimized.
Correct. Right. So that's the first table. The second table is those that are victimized. And the last table talks about the makeup of our community, the makeup of the city of Portland. Yeah, we do.
Difficult slide.
Yeah. And is it possible, Carla, to bring the lights up just a little bit?
Yeah.
I don't have a very good...
So the, in terms of the victimization, that's that second bar of numbers. Among African Americans, the victimization of aggravated assault or attempted murder with a gun of all victims, 40.8% African American, and that compares to the race of people living in the city of Portland of 6.5%. You can see the other comparison between victimization compared to percentage of population by comparing those two graphs.
So this sort of lays a bit of the groundwork of, about some of the problems that we're trying to address in terms of our approach.
So that's, if I could ask the chief, in terms of, we worked with you and your team in putting together the, and we'll talk about the specific tools later, but if you could maybe just talk a little bit about, from your vantage point as someone who's, you know, started work at the Boys and Girls Club all the way up now to Chief of Police, how you've seen this peak and valley, and specifically illegal use of firearms or irresponsible use of firearms. If you could just sort of share a little bit of your perspective, that would be great.
Thank you. Well, it's disheartening to say the least, because when I started in law enforcement back in 1989, gangs were overtaking many of our neighborhoods in inner north and northeast Portland, and they were spreading. Gangs were spreading out of that community to outer east. The gang violence was exploding. We had drive-by shootings and shots fired calls every single day in the city of Portland. So many that our officers could not respond to them unless there were injuries or property damage. And through the good work that we did with the community and, quite honestly, the advent of community-based policing, we made significant strides in our neighborhoods. And with our partners in youth gang outreach and the schools, we saw a really significant decline in gang violence. As I said, it's very disheartening to see that dynamic change. And I think we may have taken our eyes off the ball a little bit and not have stayed as focused as we should have, and we're paying a price for that as a community, and now we have to do something different to take that environment away. The numbers, particularly in this year, are pretty striking in terms of the number of gang violence reduction team call-outs, and it really exploded in May and June, and we saw a huge spike in the number of call-outs, and particularly around shots fired with people being hit.
Thank you.
So that sort of gives you a little bit of background and some context. The next piece of this is going into some of the solutions that are in front of you today. And what did we rely on to come up with some of these solutions? What we did is we looked at really best practices and relied on expertise to help shape what's in front of you today. Studies and best practices, we looked at other jurisdictions. What are they doing to address some of these problems? We took a look at organizations to help potentially address the gaps and what are some of those opportunities to partner with some of those organizations. There is some work that still needs to continue on that front, and we'll get into some of that as we take a look at the comprehensive strategy that is being drafted between the LIPSIC committee. We also looked at what are the gaps here at the city in terms of some of the gun laws, and what are some additional tools that we can add to the toolkit.
So if it would be okay if I could welcome co-chair of the Local Public Safety Coordinating Council, former state legislator and co-chair of the and Multnomah County Commissioner. I knew there were three things. Judy Shiprack up, maybe Kate or Warren or somebody could. So we have a, before we go, we're going to go through just a few of the sections of the.
Jenny just arrived.
Oh, good. So Warren, if you wouldn't mind. Senator Burdick, please come up. Yep. So if you wouldn't mind, Commissioner, State Senator Jenny Burdick has joined us and would like to provide you courtesies of the chamber. For those of you that are not familiar with the service of State Senator Jenny Burdick, it includes a determined focus on improving safety by addressing issues related to illegal gun use or irresponsible gun use. And so I wanted invited the senator here for two reasons. One, to thank you for those years of service and focus. When I look back, when we look back through the clips of some of the coverage, I was struck by your resolve and how mean-spirited this debate can become. So we stand on your shoulders today in considering these items, and so I would thank you for that and want to give you a few minutes to talk about the issue from your perspective and why you focused on it.
Thank you very much. And if you've been through the clips thoroughly, you will also find another name there, and he's right on your own very council, and it's Commissioner Leonard. My experience, again, for the record, I'm Jenny Burdick. I'm the state senator for Senate District 18. My involvement with gun safety issues, and I do call it gun safety. I don't use other terms that are more loaded, as you would. Began when I first ran for election in 1996, and it had always bothered me that no one talking about guns at all was kind of a third rail. So I joined with law enforcement people and other people who were a lot of doctors, frankly, and developed a proposal to close the gun show loophole to require background checks at gun shows. Those were, at the time, gun shows were just completely unregulated bazaars where, you know, people, gang members, juveniles, criminals, anybody could get a gun. And the Portland Police Department was very, very helpful in developing this. But in the course of that, I also had conversations with literally hundreds of gun owners. And I want to, just based on those conversations, I want to first commend you for doing something that gun owners do support, and that is trying to develop policies to keep guns out of the wrong hands, away from children, away from criminals. And even if gun owners are a little bit inconvenienced by that at times, they are generally supportive because most gun owners are very responsible and very willing to consider strong laws to keep us safe from gun violence. So as you go forward with your work, I want to offer you not only my help in any way I can, but to also encourage you to actively involve the responsible gun-owning community in your conversations. As Commissioner Leonard will be able to tell you, this is not an issue to be taken on by the faint of heart. I've had threats veiled and otherwise. I have had the attention of state police at times working on this issue. So it's not for the faint of heart, but do not let that discourage you. Because when we finally get, Commissioner Leonard and I actually got good, strong bills through both the House and the Senate, which incidentally were under Republican control at the time. And it failed by a single vote in the last days of the session. So we did a ballot measure to require background checks at gun shows, and it passed statewide by 62%, which is roughly the percentage of households that are gun-owning households in Oregon. So, again, I want to commend you, Mr. Mayor. I know what you go through, or anyone else who works on this issue, and I admire you for keeping your focus and keeping your attention on the issue. The other side sometimes, like the organized gun lobby, sometimes likes to say, guns don't kill people. People kill people. But people without guns can't kill people with guns. And so that is something that we have to keep in mind. So thank you for doing this, and I will help in any way I can.
Thanks, Senator. Appreciate it very much. And we know you have a very busy schedule, so we will not be offended if you have to leave the chambers. But we really appreciate you taking the time to be here and offering your support.
I'll wait and see if there are questions after the others.
Commissioner.
Well, this is just a delightful surprise, frankly, that I find myself sitting next to Senator Burdick. So that's an honor. I'm delighted to see you. I'm Multnomah County Commissioner Judy Shiprock. I am the co-chair of LPSC, the Local Public Safety Coordinating Council, together with co-chair Mayor Adams. And the Public Safety Coordinating Council has quite a long history of work on prevention, intervention, and enforcement strategies to address gang violence in Multnomah County. And I think that the City Council has in front of it the proposed action plan to reduce youth and gang violence, which includes the mayor's recommendations, several recommendations, which have become part of this draft plan. And I want to talk about the importance of the process that the Public Safety Coordinating Council is able to bring to its work because of the breadth of representation, both geographic and in representing all of the partners in the public safety system, and the importance of communication and coordination of the efforts that all of those parties, and I would say partners, bring to their work for the community, and particularly in gang intervention. I think that one of the violence reduction strategies that has worked for us is to provide this effective coordination and oversight, and in addition to that, to support the engagement of the entire community. And I think that we've seen that this is a cyclical problem, that we focus our attention on it, it gets better, and then we relax and we lose our focus, as Chief Reese just said. We probably this has probably occurred, and with really devastating results in the community. I find it really encouraging at the LPSC table that when the mayor comes forward with plans like this, that we get this kind of action, that we have people around the table, including the United States Attorney's Office, who step up and offer their help to coordinate efforts that the Police Department in Gresham and the Portland Police Bureau have been working really effectively together to address the problems that exist across those political boundaries, as well as coordinating their efforts on the boundary areas themselves. The Local Public Safety Coordinating Council met this month and had an opportunity to review the proposal, and their comments and really their demeanor in that review was overwhelmingly positive, but they didn't take a vote of support. The Multnomah County Commission will be voting on this package following what I expect to be the adoption of the package, or the support of the package, by the LPSC in January. There is no reason that we can't move ahead on a large number of the recommendations, and I believe that we already are, and that the individual agencies are moving ahead on those recommendations. But as far as our procedure, we, as a Board of County Commissioners, will be acting shortly after the LIPSC action in January of 2011.
Well, I want to thank you. I don't know that folks, the fact that you have legislative background in state legislature, the fact that you have prior work on the local public safety coordinating council makes you an absolute ideal co-chair, and I feel very lucky to serve with you because you know a lot more about most of these issues than I do. So I want to thank you for your mentoring and your work on this.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
And then if you're both welcome to leave. Or you can stay. I never know quite how to do that politely. It's like you're welcome to stand down. And we've got more of our presentation to go through. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Senator. Really appreciate it. Part of the slides that we will just click through quickly that Commissioner Co-Chair Shiprack just summarized, if we could click through those to the gun turnout event slide. Among other things, when you talk to people like David Kennedy, who's an expert in this area, he will tell, he counsels sort of conceptually two things. One, make sure that you have adequate peacekeepers and that you have a strategy and that strategy should include the first bullet, making it really easy for those that want to turn away from a life of violence and a life of crime, make it really easy for them to do so and to do so successfully. And that includes everything from a single phone number, that includes outreach by former folks that have been involved in illegal gang activity to help mentor them through that transition. It includes a lot of things. So we're working on that, and that's what Commissioner Shiprack spoke to. In the short term, we will have a gun turn-in event. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so we're in partnership with Oregon Ceasefire, Portland Police, and the City of Portland. We are holding a gun turn-in event this year. On December 18th, there's a typo on the slide, so apologies, but from 10 to 2 p.m., it will be held at the Benton parking lot in the Memorial Coliseum area. So we're really excited to be in partnership with this event, and we'll be announcing more details about that event.
And the Benton parking lot is just
north
of Memorial Coliseum.
Correct. So getting into what it is, the five proposals today.
And if I could do a little more stage managing.
Yes.
Mr. Chief, you're welcome to, if you wouldn't mind stepping down, and I could have Assistant City Attorney Dave Warble come up before we get into the specifics of the five proposals. If you could talk about the issue of preemption, state preemption, and also we circulated an email from the City Attorney's Office earlier about there was a column in the Oregonian that talked about potentially hefty expenditures defending these proposals in court, and we sent out an email from the City Attorney's Office explaining why that is unlikely. But if you could cover both of those topics, that'd be great.
Sure. David Wolber with the City Attorney's Office. Mr. Mayor, Commissioners. The direction to the group putting these new policies together was to work within the state preemption laws. There was no intent to defy the legislature. At first glance, when you look at the preemption statute, you might think that the legislature meant to take to itself regulation of anything having anything whatsoever to do with firearms. Closer look, that's not the case. What they did was they kept to themselves the authority, the sole authority, to regulate eight activities in which people can engage with firearms. And they are sale, acquisition, transfer, ownership, possession, storage, transportation, and use. It is not the universe of everything that might possibly have to do with firearms. It's a limited list. It's an expansive list. It's extensive. It's many activities in which people engage with firearms, but it is limited. We looked hard at that, looked at some of the policy initiatives around the country, and chose those that seemed to work to address the problems the mayor's office wanted to address while not getting crosswise with the state's legislature on preemption. As we go through these, perhaps I don't want to jump ahead too far. As we go through, I can discuss why we think that each of these mm-hmm. is not preempted. As a survey, though, let me first say that curfew, for instance, the curfew regulation has nothing to do with firearms. It is a regulation of people who have been convicted or adjudicated of mishandling firearms in the past in semi-illegal way. Again, has nothing to do with people's actual interaction with firearms. Access doesn't require storage in any particular way. The reporting requirement doesn't have to do with ownership. In fact, it happens after the ownership is terminated. Carrying a loaded firearm is specifically allowed. Our regulation in Portland of carrying a loaded firearm is specifically allowed by the legislature. These proposals change only the penalties, well within Portland's authority very clearly. And the hotspots law, again, has to do not with how a person interacts with a firearm, but with where people who have been adjudicated for violating firearms laws can go in the city.
May I just ask a technical question? Dave, are we being asked to adopt a package and a single ordinance with a severability clause, or are we going to be asked to adopt seven specific action items so that in the event of a legal challenge, they're all separate?
There are separate. The council directs clause has subsections. So you will be giving direction on a number of different subjects separately, in our view. So they are, you will enact each one of them separately. This is not like an omnibus bill that might be many different substantive provisions to be adopted at the same time.
Just to put it in plain English, meaning that were there to be a challenge on anything we adopt, the way it's being proposed would mean that someone would have to challenge a specific action. They couldn't jam the entire package.
That's correct. Each of these laws will stand on their own.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I'd also like to point out that if there has been, over the last couple of decades, that this particular preemption clause has been in place, if there have been legal challenges in the state, we're not aware of them.
I don't know of any proposals like those before you that have been adopted and challenged, correct?
So we have challenged over the last couple of decades a number of laws and sought to improve upon a number of laws, but we have not on this sort of general area. It is time that this preemption be clarified, and therefore I think, as I expect it likely will be challenged, I think that is very useful to clarify through the courts what the preemption is. I also want to make the point that, and then maybe you can speak to what the financial risks might be, but I'd also like to sort of speak to our city attorneys get paid salaries, and the council is very strategic in how that resource, legal resource, those great folks like you and others in the city attorney, how their time is used. We spend a lot of time in court as a very large municipal corporation that serves the people of this city. We spend time in court on everything from fender benders to cracked leaves to all kinds of other challenges. And council consideration today is and would be adding to that those important list of legal priorities the importance of, if we are challenged, defending these in court. So we're doing that. We'd be doing that consciously. Can you talk a little bit about the potential financial risks of a challenge?
It is an ongoing responsibility of the city attorney to defend the city's laws and actions. All of the laws that are on the books are subject to challenge. Occasionally they are, and we respond to those in the normal course of business and as part of our regular office functions. In that sense, there may be increased activity in our office, but no greater expense. We are something of a fixed cost in your overhead. The challenge, if there are challenges in criminal court, we will assist the district attorney's office in defending the legitimacy and the constitutionality of these laws, again, in the regular course of business and with no added expense. There may be challenges in federal court, challenges to constitutionality of these proposals, whether or not they violate people's civil rights. Again, that's something we do in the regular course of business. No additional cost, although there could be damages exposure in those cases. And that, like as with any law that you pass, is a consideration about whether or not you're going to be exposing the city unduly to that kind of damage award exposure.
So is it fair to say you're just standing by anxiously awaiting for us to get sued?
That's our job, is to be ready for when you get sued.
But David,
case?
Dave, in light of that, since another columnist in a piece has raised the issue about whether we sought an advisory opinion from the Attorney General's office or whether we are consulting with them on the question of state law, can you address that?
We haven't talked to them directly about these, no. That's a function we provide for you. Their advice would be interesting, not binding on you, certainly. And it may be down the road that if one of these is challenged in criminal court, that we have the Attorney General by our side on appeal defending these laws.
We also found in consulting with Mayors Against Gun Violence that that the likelihood of court challenge is high, and that going through the process of an attorney, non-binding Attorney General's opinion is most cities that seek to take some action just go directly to passage and everyone goes to court, or at least some of it ends up in court. Thank you. You've worked, it's my opportunity to thank you. You worked really hard on this since May. I think my first day as police commissioner was to ask you to work on two issues of great concern. One was child sex trafficking and the other was guns. So thank you for your work in this area.
You're welcome to it.
I'd like to turn over to Kate Lieber to talk about each of the individual pieces to this.
Thank you, Mayor, Council. The first exhibit that we have is a special curfew for juvenile firearm offenders who are on supervision. This proposal imposes a special curfew for minors who have been found by a court to have violated gun laws and are on supervision. The special curfew hours are 7 p.m. to 6 a.m. These hours were chosen quite deliberately. We found that 79% of the shooting calls occurred between 8 p.m. and 8 a.m. In addition, from working with the police on this, there's anecdotal evidence that a lot of activity, gang activity, occurs around the athletic events. And so we wanted to make the 7 p.m. A time that we could make sure that it captured the athletic events as well. There are exceptions, and this special curfew does add on to the curfew that already exists here in the city of Portland. But the exceptions that we have are any school or church-sponsored activities or events, and any activity with permission from the juvenile court counselor. In addition, this curfew only lasts for the length of the juvenile court jurisdiction or probation that they're on through juvenile court.
Question, does the word church also mean mosque, synagogue, and other religious buildings?
Yes, I believe
that's the intent.
That's the intent.
So the exception reads that basically the juvenile equivalent of probation officer can also prescribe exceptions, approve exceptions beyond this list as well.
That's correct.
And could you explain just generally how does that exception work? You're a minor covered by this, and you're stopped by a police officer, you have to produce some documentation, or there's someone else who has to be contacted. How would it work?
Yep, and you've anticipated my very next slide, how it works. So the Juvenile Justice Department will provide officers with photos and any exceptions, or basically their probationary terms that the minor may have, so precinct officers can easily determine if the youth is violating this curfew ordinance. And then the officers will initiate investigation and enforcement only of those that they are familiar with or who's subject to a curfew. And officers will not confront a minor about their curfew status without reason to believe the particular minor is subject to the new curfew provision.
The estimate, in terms of numbers, is between 20 and 30 individuals. And as when we hear from the police, 20 or 30 individuals, again, that have gone through the court process have been adjudicated for this, and it lasts only during the term of their probation. Pictures, exceptions, reasons will be available to all the police officers.
Yeah. The benefits that we feel this curfew, a special curfew, provides are, again, this is a tool to intervene for the police with a juvenile who has shown disregard for the gun laws. It also helps prevent youths from engaging in gun violence by allowing an officer to detain a youth for a curfew violation. And it will enable the officer, if the officer is going to transport that particular youth, it will enable the officer to search the youth for illegal contraband, including guns.
And just, we're going to hear in a minute from the DA's office and Lieutenant Hendry. As been described to us, this tool is useful because there are a small number of very violent youth that extricating, that sometimes serve as a spark for other violence. And it is very difficult through the system of supervision and probation right now. Police do not have the legal right to enforce probation. It is only the probation officer.
Can I just ask another question on the curfew? Assuming one of these minors, I'm assuming there can be instances where it's difficult to determine where home is for some particular minor. That there may actually be no adult, or it may not be a biological parent. There may be some other arrangement, maybe a friend and the like. So how do you determine where the person is supposed to be during the curfew period?
It will be dealt with exactly like the current curfew is dealt with. We have a curfew here in Portland. The special curfew moves it. Dave Hendry will come and address, I think, that particular issue for you regarding exactly how a police officer acts when they encounter any minor with a curfew violation.
But theoretically, could a minor subject to this be at a friend's house and be covered by the curfew while they're at someone else's house?
No, the curfew only applies if they're on a public street or public right-of-way. So for example, a minor who's staying over at a friend's house is fine because they're not on a public street or a public right-of-way. But if they enter the public street or public right-of-way during these times, then that's when the curfew stands.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. The second proposal we have for you today is endangering a child.
More item on that. This is not a violation of law. It is a violation that then is subject to the probation officers and the parent or guardians to deal with.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
So it doesn't add to their criminal sheet necessarily.
Correct. Yes. The second proposal we have for you is endangering a child by allowing access to a firearm. This would hold a person accountable if they fail to prevent access to a firearm by a minor when the person knew or reasonably should have known a minor could gain access. It provides increasing penalties as the danger increases, but it also provides specific defenses. If the minor obtains the firearm through illegal entry, that is a defense. If the firearm is kept in a locked container in a location that a reasonable person would believe is secure, is a defense, and a firearm with a lock device on it is also a defense. I'm just going to touch on preemption. I know that Dave Warborough already touched on it, but under preemption law, the city cannot address the sale, acquisition, transfer, ownership, possession, storage, transportation, or use of firearms, their components, or ammunition. This proposal really addresses only management of access to firearms. Affirmatively, this law does not prohibit a gun owner from storing a gun in any manner they wish. We sought some guidance from the National Rifle Association, and this is from a pamphlet directly for information for parents from the National Rifle Associations. And it says, in a home where guns are kept, the degree of safety a child has rests squarely on the child's parents. While specific security measures may vary, a parent must, in every case, assess the exposure of the firearm and absolutely ensure that it is inaccessible to a child. The third proposal is failure to report theft.
Commentary is this has been enacted in other locales around the United States. This is not a brand new concept for the Portland City Council.
Correct, and it was looked at as a best practice in other states to enact these laws with all of the other cities that we looked at. So the third proposal is failure to report theft or a lost firearm. This proposal, a person shall report the theft or loss of a firearm within 24 hours of knowing or having reason to know that it has either been stolen or is missing. We ask that the serial number, when they report, and they will report to the chief of police or his designee, we ask that the serial number also be reported. Questions have come up about why the serial number. Well, this enables the police to track the weapons that were used in illegal activities more effectively, allows for the police to be able to readily identify rightful owners and return weapons that are recovered, and it also makes hot guns hotter, should dissuade some of the now hot guns that are being trafficked back and forth as stolen guns. The benefits that we feel for the failure to report law ordinance are that they deter the criminal use of lost or stolen weapons, they prevent unwarranted criminal accusations against owners who suffer a loss or a theft of a firearm, and they deter persons from falsely claiming that a firearm was lost or stolen to avoid punishment for an illegal firearm transfer. Essentially, what we're trying to get out here is straw buyers. Sometimes you will have people who lose firearms multiple times. And what is likely happening is they are purchasing them legally and then selling them on the streets. And we're trying with this law to make sure that we identify who those people are and make sure that we can keep an eye on what happens to the firearms that they purchase.
Do all guns have serial numbers? Like, do hunting rifles have serial numbers?
I believe so, but that is a question we could probably ask the police. But I believe every firearm does have a serial number, yes. The fourth exhibit is we are simply increasing the penalties for possession of a loaded firearm. Possession of a loaded firearm is currently a city ordinance. We are increasing the penalties for this in that the court now may be able to impose a sentence up to 6 months imprisonment or a fine not to exceed $500 for those who possess a loaded firearm within the city limits. In addition, if that loaded firearm is possessed within a vehicle, the court must impose a mandatory minimum of 30 days. There are a number of exceptions that currently are law right now in the ordinance, and those, of course, still remain. Of course, the benefits of this is that it creates a meaningful penalty that is more proportionate to the danger that the carrying a loaded firearm in the city limits pose to the community. It recognizes the particular danger posed by loaded firearms illegally possessed in vehicles by providing the mandatory minimum.
And just one point of amplification here. Through this, working on this proposal since May, I've been surprised at how many Portlanders are surprised that it is totally legal to walk down the street with a firearm as long as it is unloaded. It is not legal to be in a public place with a loaded firearm unless you have a concealed weapons permit, if the weapon is concealed.
Do you need a permit if it's not concealed?
No, as long as it's unloaded.
So it's not legal to carry a loaded weapon at all, even with a permit, if it's visible?
With a permit, if you have a concealed weapons permit, you may carry a loaded firearm.
It doesn't
it
have
to be concealed. It cannot be concealed.
Correct. It must be concealed, unless, of course, you're a police officer,
right,
and there's a number of other people who can carry.
Thank you.
The fifth proposal is we're proposing to create some illegal firearm hotspots. Hotspots are areas where the number of firearm-related crimes are significantly higher than other areas of the city. Persons with firearm-related convictions or adjudications are going to be excluded from those areas, and we'll get to where those are in a minute. They're only excluded after a conviction or adjudication by a court for firearm use or possession laws, and the exclusion only lasts for the length of their probation or jurisdiction. And probation applies to adults, jurisdiction applies to youth. Exclusions to be enforced through arrests for trespass, but again, there are many variances that will be available for the necessary and non-harmful activities, and those are all spelled out within the ordinance itself. So how are the hotspots designated? Well, the Portland Police Bureau data was used regarding the location of shooting calls, aggravated assaults and attempt murders with a weapon, with a gun, excuse me, and all gun-related murders. These were mapped on a city maps to create what we consider the hotspots. The hotspot areas that we are proposing are three of the essentially eight separate areas that were identified through this hotspot data that we collected. The three areas are outlined. Of course, these are just really some broad outlines. The specifics of exactly where they are also located within the ordinance itself.
We chose, the chief and his team are very helpful in choosing streets. It doesn't really show up here in terms of how do you know if you're in or out. Busy streets, streets that go all the way through. So you can almost, you can verbally describe the hotspot boundary for each of the areas that we propose to designate. You'll notice as well that there are other hotspots. We chose the three worst. You could, the numbers probably justify more, but we're going to start with the three and see what happens.
And just to reemphasize that four out of these eight hotspots that we've sort of identified have been historical hotspots for at least two decades. So this is a problem that's very well rooted in a number of neighborhoods.
Just to amplify on that a little bit, there are parts of town that continue to be a place in which gun violence occurs. You'll see the hotspot on the west side tends to be in or around entertainment establishments. That is, these three, the two on the right of the screen have been, like Kate said, hotspots for two decades. The new hotspot is 162nd and Burnside, roughly. That is a hotspot that's come to sad fruition in, what, the last decade? And even if folks, at one time gangs would fight over territory and turf, these have sort of become, in some ways, even though many of the families and gang members have left and live in other parts of the city, they still often return to these parts of town and engage in criminal violent activity.
We are, and the mayor has insisted on this, putting ongoing review by an oversight committee. This committee will meet bimonthly. They will report findings to the city council every 6 months. And they will have the data they need in order to support the continued designation of hotspots. They will assess the use and need for these ordinances, and they will make certain that there is no disparity of treatment in the enforcement of the hotspot ordinance. If there's not the data to support the continuation of the hotspots, they will come back to City Council and report that to you. Benefits we feel of the hotspot ordinance is it provides law enforcement with a tool for contacting and removing people who have, again, shown a disregard for firearm use or possession laws. It protects communities suffering from the illegal use of firearms by restricting the presence of those people. And it does prevent rival gangs from locating each other in known gang territory, essentially hoping that we're hoping that if they can't find each other, they won't shoot at each other.
So that's what's in front of you today. We are happy to take any questions and try to provide the best answers for you. We also have a few folks that could talk a little bit more in detail about their experiences.
And just to clarify, the oversight committee will provide oversight and look at the data for all the initiatives. So could we have Penny from Oregon Ceasefire, Lieutenant Hendre from the Police Bureau, and Pat Callahan from Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. So these five, six, one overarching strategic approach and the five gun safety initiatives were put together, in, obviously in consultation with the DA's office and the Police Bureau's office, with a mind to being realistic about the budget. So these are tools that can be used during the everyday work of the police bureau. It will not require lots of additional spending in order for them to work. And do you want to talk a little bit more about your work and why you believe these are helpful?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Mayor and council members, for giving me an opportunity to speak about the new ordinances that are put forth today. My name is Dave Hendry. I'm a lieutenant with the City of Portland Police Bureau. And my current assignment is in the Tactical Operations Division, and I'm responsible for the gang enforcement team and its activities within the city. I have been with the city for 17 years, and through those times I've had various assignments in the city, like many of the officers here. But specifically, I spent 6 years working as a gang enforcement officer in a uniform capacity. And so I was here when gang violence was at its peak, and I remember those days very clearly, and I remember the sadness on the faces of many family members who lost loved ones during those times. And because of that, I have a strong interest in these rules and laws and ordinances that are put in place. Throughout my career, I have been around gang violence. Anywhere in the city now you go, there will be gang violence. It is something we're working on. It's an active problem. I've had the opportunity to be a sergeant up in robbery. And when I was a sergeant up in the robbery detail, again, guns and gang violence were part of my day-to-day work. And obviously, my current assignment as a lieutenant of the gang enforcement team, I see all that's out there. Specifically, these ordinances, I think, give us a lot of opportunity and a lot of tools for law enforcement. I think we can all agree that there are rules that are in place that may or may not be as effective as they could be. How does this look for a working officer on the street when they're making contacts with gang members? And there's three of these ordinances I specifically want to address and how I see that relating to the day-to-day operations. The curfew violation, for instance, there's a 7 o'clock curfew if you've been adjudicated by as a juvenile for a gun crime or the use of a gun in commission of a crime. Why is that important to us? Well, for law enforcement, it is important because we are not worried about these individuals being inside of a home, visiting family, or going to church or school activities. We're worried about them congregating in areas that we know are prone to having more violence. These individuals, these juveniles, if they have chosen to carry guns, have already made a choice to become violent within our city. The sheer fact that you are carrying a gun is a choice, and the choice to carry that gun has implications. For us to be able to see folks that we know, and we work very closely with juvenile parole and probation to find out who is under their jurisdiction, who has already had a gun conviction, it allows us to see those people on the street when they shouldn't be out there congregating and remove them from a situation that's potentially violent and hostile. That is what I see as being a great benefit for that curfew violation. People are always concerned that, well, how does that impact my kid if my kid is not one of these kids? Will they be contacted, by the police by mistake, or will they suffer an intense police scrutiny because they're with these people? I'm sure that is going to happen at some times. We try to minimize that risk, but I think it's important for council members to understand that our officers, again, work very clearly. They know who is carrying the guns illegal. They know who are the active folks who should not be in possession of those firearms by face and name. And so I think it's a little bit more specific than being indiscriminate, as some people are concerned about. As it relates to the enhanced penalties, I have worked the street before where we used to issue citations for people who already had a booking photo for carrying a gun in the city. That is disconcerting to me, and that when I arrest somebody who may or may not have decided to take my life or the life of my partner, but because of our tactics, we were able to overcome that. When you write a citation and they go bye-bye for as long as it takes for them to get out of the precinct doors, it's disconcerting when we would see them later in the evening. I think having some of these rules, specifically the 30-day mandatory minimum if you're caught with a firearm inside of a vehicle or a transit system, is a huge benefit to law enforcement and to the community in general, and that it removes people from those areas and it takes away their ability to move throughout the city indiscriminately to go and do forth gang violence or violence in general. I think that is a very positive step. And then lastly, I want to talk about the hot spots. If you asked any of the working officers who have been with the city for the last decade, and I know it says it goes back 2 decades, we could tell you where the areas of most violence is. That is not unknown to us. And it is these areas that, for a variety of reasons, whether it's business, whether it's intersection, where it's the place where it's more popular to hang out, if it's a park, these are areas that consistently have drawn violence. And the ultimate goal of all of us, I think, as we sit here today, and specifically our overarching goal in the Tactical Operations Division, is to reduce gang violence in the city. That's our ultimate goal. I see the enforcement of the hotspots as being another tool for us, and specifically for my uniform officers, to be able to do their job effectively with the least amount of intrusion upon those who are not the ones that are choosing to do violent acts, but happen to live in those communities where there is a lot of violence. The ability to go into an area when you know someone has been convicted or adjudicated with a gun crime, see them and be able to remove them and be able to check them for contraband, specifically firearms, is an amazing tool for us. There is nothing more frustrating than when you see people in a crowd that you know are up to no good because people have been telling you that. And you hear it on the street from other gang members and you hear it from community and know that we're waiting. We're waiting for them to do something. This allows us to be preventative. It allows us to go in there to those situations, to those areas where there's large congregation and propensity of violence, to remove them before we have another incident as we had downtown.
Can I ask just a follow-up question on that?
Sure.
Because I think you make a very eloquent argument, but according to the map, the number of hot spots that have been identified is a very small fraction of the city.
Yes.
And so under this proposal, if word gets out, you're going to clearly be discouraging people from congregating in those locations. So how do you address the concern that some are likely to make that it just displaces the problem?
Well, I think there is definitely, anytime we talk about enforcement action, we talk about putting more pressure in a location, there is displacement. That is that's a natural factor when it comes to law enforcement activities. After there's a shooting, we have a high level of police action, and then for a while that area goes desolate. There's no one on the street, and I understand that. I think the angle that I see on this that is super important is that even when we have applied pressure to these places, they always return. There's historical evidence that suggests that these locations are the most violent areas in our city and that has not changed regardless of enforcement actions or missions that have been run. And so I think there's a fair amount of consistency there. And I can't get into the minds of the individuals or, why these areas are, but they have been. And I think that's the idea behind, and I'm sure there's some folks who are much more able to talk about this than I, who will say that when we look at these areas, as we see the areas shifting, and that is reviewed to determine if these hot spots are still valid and adequate, we're willing to move around to ensure that we, keep this tool in place so that we keep the city safe.
Mayor Adams, a couple of weeks ago, you sent me a text saying there was an incident in Holiday Park and you wanted some action. And so the Parks Bureau implemented some of the SEPTEB principles to improve sight lines and do some other things, improve lighting. One thing in connection with this that I think I'd be interested in knowing more about is, to the extent there's a hotspot that would be subject to this ordinance, are there if it is adjacent to a park or adjacent to some housing we invest in or a public facility of some kind, are there additional things we can do under SEPTED and other tools that we have to try to minimize the attractiveness of that location for certain kinds of activity?
Thank you, Commissioner Fish. Under your leadership, Parks moved, and we worked with transportation as well, but Park moved faster than I've ever seen them move before to better lighting, trimming of trees, putting up fences in a way that all made the park safer. So thank you. And, yes, we need to do that. Thank you. I just want to relate people back to the entertainment district downtown and the entertainment establishments downtown. The nature of the services, the nature of the activities there aren't going to change. It's going to continue to be a place that attracts a whole big swath of the city for entertainment purposes. So if there's displacement from that unique collection, if the displacement is to somewhere else that isn't so heavily loaded to that kind of establishments, your folks have told me that it would be, especially for folks that have been adjudicated by a court, and that's how this is different than previous exclusion zones, and it isn't, you have to be excluded for a gun crime, not just any crime,
correct.
And it's for your term or probation. It's not forever. It's clearly ends. If you're successful in probation, you get to go back into the hotspots, even if it's a gun crime. But it really, my ride-alongs with you and then my ride-alongs with some recovering gang members as well, was really eye-opening to me about sort of that geographic piece of this. It's not the only